Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com or download the Whole Foods Market app to learn more and find the store nearest to you.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Morgan Harris, head sommelier at Aureole, right here in New York City. Well, actually, we're in Brooklyn. We'll talk to Morgan about wine, what else? Psalms, Aureole, and more. We'll taste, well, I think maybe I'm going to subject Morgan to a blind tasting and see how he does. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Seattle-born Morgan Harris made his way to New York and jumped into the wine game full-time at about, around 2011. He cut his wine teeth with master sommelier Laura Maniac at Cork Buzz Wine Studio, did a short stint at John George before moving to Charlie Palmer's Aureole in New York City as head sommelier. Morgan was named Wine and Spirits Best New Sommelier. He holds an advanced sommelier certificate and is also, are you still an instructor at the American Somm Association?
I do from time to time teach. Okay. With Andrew Bell.
That's right. All right. Morgan, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Glad to have you on. A lot of stuff to talk about. But before we get into everything, I want you to kind of frame for everyone who you are. So give us a quick background on your journey in life and wine that got you to where you are today, which is at Aureole and sitting with me in Brooklyn.
Yeah. So I grew up in Seattle and I moved to Boston to go to college and found myself working in restaurants. I have an undergraduate degree in acting and sort of knew I was going to have someone to make a living, right? In the meantime, and I actually have I'm the SAG must join, and you know, did some acting stuff for the first 2-3 years here. I was in the Bats down at the Flea, so some moderate successes, and I just really didn't enjoy the process of it. But I found myself working in restaurants, and wine is basically the opposite of.
Wait, you worked in restaurants because you had to
I had to pay the bills.
The classic story.
Yeah. Right. I mean, like, I made some very small amount of money during my acting career,
right.
but nowhere near.
It was about the acting, not the
living
money.
Living in. Right. So, and I found the wine community in New York, you know, this is sort of 2000, I graduated in 2008, so this would have been sort of 08 through 10, was kind of the opposite of the acting community, which is everybody was. You know, in acting, everybody's trying to crawl over everybody else to get the next step. And right. Wine is very horizontal. I think that has to do with sort of the shared nature of a bottle and how, well, okay, I can drink a whole bottle myself, but I'd rather drink two with you. Right?
Fair enough.
So I've always kind of been interested in a lot of things, and wine synthesizes a lot of my interests, history, geography, drinking.
Was there
people?
A person, place, or moment? That sort of clarified that for you?
Yeah, in 11, I had, I went through a really bad breakup and left the city for like 3 months, and I decided to go work a harvest in Eastern Washington at Waters Winery, which works with Gramercy Cellars. They were in the same building. So Walla Walla Syrah, and I just had a lot of time to sit in a truck and think about, well, you know, okay, I'm 25 years old. There's only one time in my life where I'm going to know more than most people my age about wine, so let's see how that's into. But really seeing the process and that, you know, there are super hard people who are making wine all over the world, and while that won't necessarily be me, beginning to be that person who connects the end consumer to those hardworking people is, I think, important for both of them. It's a,
I agree.
Not a necessary part of the equation, but certainly where I fit into
it. We'll talk about that a little more, a little more into the show. All right, so you're in Washington, you escape, but you're working the harvest.
Yeah. The plan was always to come back.
You have this realization of the connection between,
you
know, farming, the farmers, the winemakers.
Yeah. And so you're, you know, you're out there, and I came back and sort of was like, okay, let's double down on this and see where it goes. And so that's when I started working for Laura, which was my first like full time. I worked in wine bars for years before, 2-3 years before that.
Right.
So I got to pick up a lot of product knowledge, but I didn't necessarily, hadn't worked fine dining or anything and with real responsibility. And I was there for about 2 years as doing most of the buying, sort of with Laura overseeing me and all that. And I was still moving through my CMS stuff. But that was a lot, you know, it was a management position, so it was 60 or 70 hours a week. And you know, a lot of responsibility for somebody who didn't have a ton of experience. So I learned a ton working there.
A lot of exposure to product.
Yeah. People, the industry.
Customers, you know, some pretty good people.
Yeah.
Laura is, you know, is adept as anybody.
Could hang out and drink champagne till 2 a.m.
Yeah, she's a big champagne lover. So you do that for a few years, like you said.
Yep.
And then what happens? You get tired? Opportunities come
well,
up?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had worked in like the casual wine bar space for close to 5 years. And, you know, Laura was going to open up more of them as she has done. You know,
right.
this is before Chelsea Market existed and
Charlotte.
And Charlotte. So, I decided that I would go, I wanted to work fine dining because I think once you learn that style of service, wherever you're going to work in the restaurant space, it's kind of like classical musicians playing jazz, right? Like you still need to work on your arpeggios and know your scales and all that stuff. Cause then you can make active decisions about what you're including or omitting in future services that you have.
Right.
So I went to go work at John George. I was not there for long, not cause I wanted to leave, but it was a misunderstanding. I had what would constitute a shift drink in any other restaurant, and that found me on the wrong side of a corporate-wide must-fire policy.
Oh,
so I, you know, everybody makes mistakes in their career, but it's
right.
how you made them.
Yeah, right.
Right. So I was there for about 6 months. And
did that worry you for the moment?
That summer was pretty stressful. Summer of 14,
right?
The 2 or 3 months I was unemployed. I was like, you learn real quick,
right.
From that. It was not a fun summer, for someone who likes working.
Right.
But yeah, so then in September of 14, I started at Oriole.
How does that come about? Somebody hooks you up, or you?
Yeah,
you're
I mean, there's a lot of it. Like I was going out for all sorts of things, and I was like very happy to be working the floor, even though I wanted to work in fine dining, and I probably wasn't going to get a program management experience in that. But I will say that my floor management experience was kind of the only reason why I got the job at John George, even though I had no fine dining experience,
because right.
The management team knew that I would know how to look at a floor. So if you are thinking to make that transition into fine dining, if you do work in restaurants, like management in a more casual spot is still an okay way to do it.
Was their perception of Cork Buzz good? I mean,
yeah, for sure. I mean, they knew
all?
Who Laura was,
right.
And it's a small
it was legit.
Yeah, actually, at the time, one of the there are 3 MSs who are named Laura, maybe 4 now. But Laura Williamson, who worked for, she's been all over the industry, but she worked for a number of years as Rudy Viest's, like national sales director. I don't know exactly what she's doing right now, but, she was head sommelier at John George at the time. So she kind of held me the job.
Okay.
So that I could have it. But then moving to Oriole, I was just looking that summer, and I had been, you know, talking with a couple of mentor figures, and this is actually when Aldo Somme was opening up the Somme Bar, and he was looking for someone for that spot, and he actually wound up taking a woman named Carrie, who had my job at Oriole, right? So we kind of all swapped
wow.
there.
Funny
so
coincidence.
He was like, well, I don't think you're the right person for this job, but you are the right person for this job, so you should go talk to Oriole. So I guess I owe it to Aldo.
Good for him. He's been on the show. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
All right, so you're one of the few Somme, certainly the guys and women that I've had on the air, that don't make wine. You don't make wine. You don't own a restaurant. You don't own a wine store. You're not writing books right now. I mean, you're sort of a somm. I mean, that's what you're doing. So I want you to give me your, I guess, definition philosophy of what you think a somm is. I mean, because it's what you do.
Right.
And it's all you do. And I don't know if you get asked it a lot, but, you know, a lot of people, there's the whole argument of being intimidated. What do these guys do? You know, what are they? Tell me your interpretation.
I think that's one of the biggest. I was recently asked by a prominent West Coast wine journalist about what's changed in the business in the last 10 years or so. And I think the difference is that everybody kind of knows what we are theoretically there when we arrive at the table, right? There's a much, because of some... both the Somm films and just more exposure is
couple
that
of shows.
I feel
on
like,
cable.
Yeah, exactly. There's some, especially under people, you know, clientele is under the age of 40 or so understands that there's less of the used car salesman bias that I get out of the sort of like 40 to 65 plus set, from younger guests, and they sort of understand that my purpose there is to just get them something yummy within right. whatever price point they may be at, and maybe they want to go on an adventure or maybe they don't want to go on an adventure, but at the end of the day I think they're less intimidated by us and more like, oh, this is a useful portion of our meal, in the same way that our waiter might tell us about steaks or whatever it is.
Wait, so clear that up for me. You're talking about under 40?
Yeah.
And you're saying 40 to 60, established clientele is a little more hesitant. They, like you said, they right. look down like, what's this used car salesman trying to sell?
Right. Is this that? I would say that the bulk of people who I get who do have that opinion of, or you get that read, that bias off of them is of an older set.
Right.
So, the amount of people who, you know, in all demographics who have a better grasp of what I'm actually functionally there for when I show up to a table is much higher than I think it was a decade ago.
Right. We'll talk about Oriel a little further because I want to talk about you, but the clientele varies. I mean, when you have a big wine list, diverse wine list, you know, big price points, I guess you're attracting all ages and still continuing to serve, you know, the older market.
Right. I mean, we're right in the heart of Times Square, so we see all sorts of people, and the clientele changes a lot over the course of the week, because the middle of the week, it's a lot of like professional dinners and lunches and stuff like that, and then towards the weekend, it's more tourists and, you know, like the Jersey
Square,
and like outer,
Tunnel.
The in for, you know, pre-theater or whatever, so
right.
we actually, I mean, I would love to see more people for, you know, dining and that sort of like after 8 o'clock set. But, you know, as New Yorkers, it's not a lot of New Yorkers unless you're going to a show, want to be in Times Square after 8 o'clock or so.
It's
so
also that's, neighborhood. I mean, Tribeca, West
right.
Village, East
There's
Village.
Places to go out afterwards.
Resident. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess the location, you know,
right,
it's a good location, but, you know, it serves that location. So what else about Assam? I mean, what else can you say? I mean, a true somm is...
Yeah, well, I mean, I think at the end of the job, if you want to talk about it that way, is, you know, someone who works in a restaurant. So, you know, by that regard, like Thomas at the Nomad, like definitely still a sommelier because he's there on the floor of his restaurant 3, 4, 5 days a week. He just happens to also make wine in the Finger
right.
Lakes.
Right. Right.
I think that's the job. So I think a lot of smarter people than me, you know, elders in the industry have made the distinction that there's a difference between the sommelier skill set and what that prepares you for and actually being a sommelier, right? You know,
right.
I think Dustin Wilson would hold this opinion that he's no longer a sommelier, but he uses his sommelier skill set plenty.
Right.
Which I think is probably the most correct way, I think, to look at sort of the distinction of people who move off the floor, because it is a time bomb, right? At the end of the day, to interface with the restaurant life, you know, as you acquire more responsibility in your life, let's say children and,
right.
and you know,
things change quickly.
You know, your parents aging, like not, you know,
yeah, the distraction,
right.
you don't even know what's going to be thrown at you. And
right.
you're working crazy hours, crazy days.
Right. You just work when everybody else plays. So at
right.
some point it becomes
night times, weekends.
Yeah. And I love the floor. I'm addicted to the energy of it, but at some point.
So what are your aspirations? I mean, you're happy doing this?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
Well, you don't.
Yeah, I mean,
You don't have to have the answer.
No, and
you may not have it, and it may not be the time to think about it. But I mean, you look like we just talked. You know, Thomas is making wine. Dustin has the store. You know, he works with the Guild Somm guys and all.
Yeah. I mean, for me, at the end of the day, it's about getting more people to drink wine and sort of recognize its place as one of our greatest cultural institutions and objects, like that, the fusion of agriculture and sort of history.
That
and
sounds like education.
Agriculture, right? Yeah. The million-dollar question there is, you know, how do you make a decent living at it without working for one of the big boys, which is not sure I want to, something I'm interested in doing either. So,
Well, if you're in no rush, sometimes things play out.
Wait to see how it presents.
The opportunity comes up and all of that.
Definitely not ruling out the writing thing, but it's sort of, what do I have to say that hasn't been said other way?
Right. Somms have some pretty wacky reputations. Good. You know, mostly good. Some crazy, some different and all that. I mean, I know a little about you. I know that you're pretty engrossed in the profession. I mean, you're tasting, you're trying to pass your tests and all that. You have all these kind of crazy routines and all of that. I mean, are you still tasting every week, tasting groups, watching your palate? Talk to me a little about like some of the things that you do besides working the floor, which we just talked about, which could be 50, 60 hours.
I'm actually, there's a, you know, the Quartermaster Sommeliers is a controversial organization in our business.
Why?
I think because of the fact that at the end of the day, there's a certain have and have not dichotomy that it creates for people who are, you know, you take somebody like Raj Parr or Patrick Capiello, who are people who I look up to a lot professionally.
Good as anyone, right?
Right. And, you know,
not certified.
Would blow my faces off on many topics, right?
They're also older than you, but I know where you're going.
I'm not saying that, but yeah. How irritating must it be to them for someone to ask them, well, on what level are you? Right, it's like, so that's the definite downside of it, and I understand people's irritations about it. And I mean, to me, the greatest thing about the court is the community around it, right? So many of the connections I've made, the people who I am close with both professionally and personally today, it's just, you know, it's a very, preparing for the exams together as a community is, I don't think there's a lot of other industries that have that sort of
horizontal support. So you're actively pursuing certification. Yeah, you've been doing it for years.
And for me, it's kind of old man on the hill, right? So to speak, right?
You didn't start as the old man.
Though. Most certainly did not. You know, it's kind of nice to be in a more leadership position now because I have sort of this dubious distinction because now I've passed all three sections of the exam, just not at the right time.
At different times, right. You know, I had Michael Engelman on. He did them all in one day. What's up with that, you know?
So, that's I view the exams as they're just a measuring stick, right?
So that's a huge backdrop in your life.
Uh-huh.
And the point I was getting to is you have all these routines. So because of the certification you're going after, you have to bone up on a lot of things. Theory, service, tasting. So, I mean, are you tasting every other day?
I mean, for
are
sure,
you not brushing your teeth? Are you
carrying trays around? I've never done nothing so crazy as that, but I'm on the floor every day. So a lot of the service stuff kind of works itself out.
You're lucky to be a service
guy. And the weirdest thing is how it happens to you on the restaurant floor. That like questions you would only ever think you get in an exam setting, they come back to you the other way.
You mean example?
Like I had this guy maybe 8 months ago and he asked for a last word, which is, or not a last word, but a Corpse Reviver. One of the great all-time classic cocktails, but it comes in three different variations. There's the Savoy, the number one, and the number two. And almost everybody means, like, the Corpse Reviver number two is the drink.
Right.
But I had to, like, ask him which do you, and it just felt like very much like one of these sort of being gaslit around the exams. Because that's exactly the sort of thing that they would put you in. And they're putting you in the most ridiculous situation of your entire career, and the expectation of is that you come out of it looking like you kept your head on your shoulders.
People don't realize that part of the exam covers spirits, right?
Yeah, for sure.
You need to know
anything you might put in a cup.
You know, you need to know drinks and all of that stuff. What we talked about a little outside, but what's in the exam? There's theory, tasting, and service.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're on the floor every day, but what is the hardest or has been the hardest thing for you to...
I mean, tasting was definitely the hardest for me as somebody who doesn't feel like he has a lot of intuitive ability around it.
You have to train yourself.
Right. It was a lot of training.
So were you tasting a couple times a week?
Yeah.
You part of groups
There was kind of like the last 2 years there was it was probably something like two and a half times a week. And the only time you can do it is at like 9 or 10 in the morning, because somebody inevitably has to go to lunch service. So, it means, you know, it's work, right? Because you get off the floor at, you know, 12:30 or 1, and
get up at 9.
You go to bed and you wake up at 9 or like 8:30, and you're back on the road again. And, you know, it's a weird gap in the middle of the day, but then you're already into Manhattan. And
so typically you'd sit with 2-3 other peers.
Yeah, at least.
Maybe more.
Sort of the big alternatings are either you do a round table format where it's sort of thematic, so you do all aromatic whites.
You how much wine are you contrast. Drinking?
I mean, spitting, but...
Spitting, right.
It's usually like one bottle per person. So we have a group on Saturday that's mixed scale, and sometimes it has 10 or 12 people. So we might do a whole flight of comparing aromatic whites and then doing a whole flight of pyrazine derivative reds. And then obviously you got to prepare for game day, so you need to do the actual exercise, which is the 6 classes, 25 minutes, right, that whole jazz.
Has that stuff helped you through the years?
I think it's value.
So it's not an overwhelming yes.
I think its value is that if there's something I see in young sommeliers is that they don't necessarily always know how to, like, what makes a grape typical, right? Like, so because you don't know what anything is, so right, you're applying the theoretical side of, well, what is a grape supposed to taste like to, you know, theory and practice. Because at the end of the day, our as buyers especially, we have to be curatorial, right? And say that this thing is a good thing for this price and that thing is a bad thing for this price. And really to create value for our clientele, I would say that blind tasting is enormously helpful to that. Because you may love a wine, but if you're buying Bordeaux and it doesn't taste anything like Bordeaux, then why are you buying it? Despite how much you may love it.
Right. That's a good point.
It's sort of understanding. It helps you to understand those wines in a vacuum.
That's a good point. A recent guest I had on, and somebody you know well, was Bianca Bosker. She wrote a book called Cork Dork. It was pretty much about her trials and tribulations of becoming a sommelier. And she's a writer, so her ability to write, you know, was terrific. You were featured prominently in the book, almost as a emotional and spiritual guy.
I did not know I would be in so much of the book when,
but in
before
reality,
the book came out.
You know, I didn't know her and I didn't know you till now. And I read the book and I'm like, Jesus, you know, Morgan's like right by her side. So I guess the question is, was her portrayal of you and her portrayal of sommeliers, was she accurate on, exaggerated, self-serving? What would you say?
I mean, I can certainly... I think her portrayal of me was accurate. I definitely recognize. I'm not everybody's cup of tea, and that sort of comes out.
You're comfortable with that?
I'm okay with that.
Okay.
You know, some of the criticisms that were leveled against the book by people like Levy Dalton and that mostly centered around sort of her relative dilettantism. And I don't think that's entirely unfounded, especially when you look at it relative to like... Bill Bruford doing Heat, right? Which is maybe your closest analog. But he was in the kitchen for like almost 2.5 or 3 years. Whereas Bianca was sort of like 6 to 9 months or something,
right,
like that.
You're talking
so,
the time.
Okay, but that is immaterial to the content of the actual book, in which I learned things for me personally about the way that we perceive taste. That does not make it a bad book, and it doesn't make it... No book can be 100% representative of any community, right? And at the end of the day, I think...
Fair for anything.
Right. I don't think she was fanciful or made anything up. I thought it was very unfortunate that they chose to introduce her to the wine world publicly. Her editors did via that op-ed in the Times.
Yeah.
I thought that was very unfortunate.
Eric Asimov.
No. Well, it was...
Oh, the other one. I'm
her
sorry.
Editors extracted something out of the book where she goes to a big like wine laboratory for
right.
Gallo or something like that.
Wines.
And... you know, that was, it was very divisive. I told her when it came out, I was like, this is going to be spicy.
Yeah.
And it wound up being so. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think one of the things we do worst as an industry is we don't allow people ways into this little shark tank that we have around wine, and that we're kind of always nipping at each other's tails rather than trying to get more fish in the tank.
Right.
So there's not a lot of pie growing. There's a lot of like, hey, can my slice be bigger?
Right.
And when you look at the existent literature, you look at something, I like Eric Asimov's book very much, but it, at the end of the day, how many people can you give it to? Because it's, of the, you know, 275 pages, is 125 pages of, you know, middle 50s man memoir, and
right,
150 pages of good wine stuff.
Right.
So that's not going to speak to everybody.
And that,
so
that's her being what it is.
A young, you know, well-educated, dynamic, vibrant young woman is a
writer,
whole other, you know, opinion on that. Which, so no, does she get everything right? No. But does she get too many things wrong? Also no.
Right.
Right. And so I think that's, it's a valuable voice to be had in the sort of the whole discussion and getting people to know what we do.
I don't think anything is so holy, you know, a profession or an industry where somebody could come in. And you made a good point about Buford and Heat, where he spent the time.
Well, he spent more time.
More time.
So
I think that book is why you don't see much about Mario Batali. I mean, it was all laid out in there pretty much.
I
think, you know, but it's no big deal if somebody goes in regardless of the time and makes their observations. And to your point, if, you know, she didn't make too many mistakes or whatever, it's just, you know, her perspective.
And because I know her as a person, how she talks about her time in the business versus what her editors and her book people were sort of pushing her as. And those are kind of two different things,
right?
And what she admits to in the book versus what,
right? I agree.
You know, it's they need to sell books, and so if that's what looks good, it's in there. They're sort of stretching the rubber a little bit.
I agree.
They're going to do that.
Enough of Cork Dork.
Yeah.
All right. So I wanted to follow up on this earlier. You said the best wines are made by great farmers, and that you, Morgan, sommelier.
Not a great farmer.
No, you, right. That's, I didn't time that right. But you, Morgan, sommeliers are the link to the people who make the wine and the people who love to drink it.
Yeah.
You know, so expand on that for me. You talked about it a little. I mean, you could curate taste, influence.
Yeah. Personally, there's no greater moment of professional reward than when I have, I know who made the wine and how he farmed it, or she, or at least how that group of people thinks about their wines in that region, whatever sort of aesthetic movement they may belong to, usually, you know, organic, biodynamic, whatever it may be. And they work hard. They want to, like, go hang out with their dog and like, maybe they drive their tractor around or hang out with their kids. They can't be here, right? You know, they don't necessarily want to be in the big old city selling wine to people. And then vice versa, the great thing about a restaurant is the sort of hospitality nature of it, which is anyone. You're coming to be taken care of, right? And you say, I'm going to spend an amount of money, and I hope to have a good time. And when you get to connect, when you get to be the person that connects those two people, and you know that they're going to be able to buy diesel for their tractor and, like, compost and whatever they need for the next year's harvest, and they don't have to come to New York to sell this bottle of wine, and then vice versa. You know, it's not the most important portion of that whole interaction, but and then that whoever your guest comes in is renewed and rejuvenated and go back to their job, whatever it may be, on Monday and go kick butt. Like, that's good. That's happy.
Two things to that. One, do you think if you didn't do that Washington harvest, you wouldn't have had that attachment to kind of what's going out on the field and farmers, or you would have?
I think I'd certainly have a less visceral appreciation of what it's like.
Yeah.
You know, like, I, speaking of dilettantes, right? I was there for 4 months. I did a whole back to front harvest, but I wasn't there for several years doing it. So I got a pretty solid upfront look at, you know, what a 16-hour harvest day looks like.
Right.
Cause I did it for 4 or 5 or 6 weeks when we were in the thick of it. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's wine is one of our finest agricultural products. And
people forget that.
I think that's one of the funniest things. Like, I'm 32, right? And you go to these dinner parties, and these people have spent however much money on organically raised, like, hormone-free beef that's grass-fed and dry-aged for 42 days. And they've got fancy cheeses on the table. They spent money on all these things. And the thing that's in the middle of the table, like, was extruded out of a tube somewhere in Fresno.
Right.
right? And that for better or worse, and I think it has to do with prohibition and sort of all alcohols being equally evil, so therefore they're all the same, and how we drink in general, like that hasn't necessarily quite sunk in with people, at least right. people my age, is that like
you're
making
the
same decisions,
that.
Right?
You know, it's an agricultural product,
right?
It's, you know, farm sustainability, right. Organics, whatever.
And if you want to buy a bottle that was actually made by a human being in their hands, you got to spend like $18 a bottle,
right?
It's kind of where it starts.
So there's right. That's
the threshold of artisanality, if you want to call it that.
So this is kind of a broad question, but you know, see if you could narrow it down to me. Is there anyone in your mind through the years, you know, because you've felt this way, that exemplifies that? I mean, is there an attachment you've had with a wine because of the story and the land and the farmer?
Yeah. For me, like when I think about professionally, my biggest inspirations, and I think about somebody like Pascaline Lepelletier, who I think at Rouge du Mont in particular, that was fully on display on the list. It's like, we're just not going to list anybody who doesn't feel this way about their farming.
Right.
Right. And we're going to do all the hard work and the homework to make sure that it's not just, they're not just slapping that on a label, but that that's actually how they do it.
But I'm talking about producers. I mean, is there somebody... You know, like when you talk about Bandol, it's hard not to talk about Tempier and Lulu.
Yeah, I mean, I went to go visit Tempier and then had a, you know, very charming visit. But, you know, you go and to wine regions and you look at people's vineyards and you're like, that looks like a living, happy thing.
Right.
Right. That looks like a place where I things are living and agriculture is happening and you know, which is ironically not really a lot of what happens in Washington.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm always inspired by people who think about that in a big way. So domestically, it's people like Steve Mathiasen and Dan Petrovsky at Massican,
yeah.
Right?
Both of them are coming on the show in the next probably 6-8 weeks.
Yeah, they're both fantastic. Or
that's in the States, which is hard to find guys like that.
Yeah, very hard.
How about
hard.
When you move to Europe? I mean, in the Loire, like Pascaline.
Yeah, I mean, the Baudrys. I mean, I think their wines always exemplify that.
Right.
And, you know, I like lively wines. I don't necessarily need them to be crazy and natural, but I want them to
a pet net with like a bacterial strain
yeah,
floating.
You know, and I like weird beers, but at some right. point, that's one of the things that comes out of I guess the formal sommelier training is you start flaws and like those things. You talk to younger sommeliers and they don't necessarily know. No, this wine just smells like vinegar, and that may be what you like about it. But let's call a spade and say that that's something that's actually obscuring the terroir here.
Right.
There's a lot of, you know, but everybody has different tolerances for that. So I see both sides of it.
Right.
Right. Like I like pretty bready wines. Other people don't like bready wines.
Right.
So it's all different.
Are people pretty good at describing what they want when they walk in here? Do you have to pull it out of most people?
The easiest
way
to do it.
That's one of the tasks that you're...
This is the sommelier trick, is you just ask them what they generally drink. It's a much easier way, because I've had that
that's
thing,
the
right?
That's the easiest
That
question.
Is the easiest way to do it.
And you take it from there.
I very rarely, I'm like, I don't want to, no, I want a fruity wine that's sweet, but also dry and not too...
I drink Rombauer at home.
Yeah, but that gives me a very firm
very
picture
so.
Of what they yeah. enjoy drinking. But people are... perennially surprising, and you
do
know,
people lie sometimes. Do they, you know, like they want to sound cool or they don't want to say sancier?
They just won't understand what they've just asked for, right?
Okay.
They're like, we'd like a dry red wine. I'm like, well, that's all 800 of them on the list,
right? Can you help
so,
me?
So, I mean, sometimes you just reply to their question form of being as you're not derogatory about it. You're just like, we haven't narrowed anything
but
down.
But you know how to narrow the queries.
Yeah, because, well, I mean, they probably mean tannic or,
right.
You know.
Or maybe European versus American.
Right, but they're not certainly not asking. They're I mean, I don't know. Maybe somebody locked them in a room somewhere and force-fed them Lambrusco and Manischewitz, but...
Isn't Lambrusco carbonated Manischewitz?
No.
No, I love Lambrusco.
I love it. Delicious.
I'm a Lambrusco evangelist.
Yeah.
All right, Morgan, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to focus on a few things. I want to talk about Aureole, the program there, some of the wines, what you're doing over there. I want to subject you to our wine list. I want to get your take on stuff. And then, like I said earlier, let's taste a little wine. Let's throw it at you blind and see what you could do. We've been talking to, we are talking to Morgan Harris. Morgan's the head sommelier at Aureal. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. From papayas and samosas to reishi mushrooms, if it's something that sounds delicious, chances are you'll find the freshest, best version of it at Whole Foods Market. They have more than 400 stores across the country, so if you consider pizza its own food group or just can't imagine when avocado toast wasn't a thing, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Visit wholefoodsmarket.com to find a store near you. Whole Foods Market. Whatever makes you whole.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Morgan Harris. Morgan's the wine guy at Aureal. Let's talk about that a little, Morgan. You've been at Charlie Palmer's Aureal for
three and a half years. Which is forever in the service industry.
It is. Young guy, too. There's a word called spilkes. After doing something for a while, you get spilkes and want to get out of there. So kudos to you. Aureal is a one-starred restaurant, you know, so it's a very happening place. Charlie Palmer is about as well-known chef-wise as anybody. So let's talk about the list there. Obviously, you got in there, and it pre-existed.
Correct.
And it's pretty damn big. So before we talk about, you know, your touches and what you're doing, how big is it? What's there? Where's the strength?
Yeah, the list, when I inherited it, and kind of obviously still as it stands today, but the restaurant opened in 88 when I was three. And we don't have anything else for the original seller, but this...
Wait, was that off the cuff or is that real?
No, that's...
Were you three in 88?
I was three in 88.
Okay.
And it's, yeah, to make it 30 years in any business is a good long time. But basically... we still have wines definitely that were purchased in the early aughts that are on the list. And it's interesting. There's definitely a ton of, it's a wine list that comes, you know, the restaurant's original heyday was the early 90s, which to me is sort of an era of like, you want a thing, you can have a thing. Like, it's America, do whatever you want.
Right.
And so we kind of do have everything on the list, but they're definitely by volume, you know, blue chip Cabernet and Burgundy. I bought a lot of Bordeaux in the last year because our clientele right now is quite keen on it. I think, frankly,
Bordeaux, Cali.
Yeah, and then obviously white Burgundy as well is what a big portion of the list. And then, you know, other than that, it's very sort of spread all over the place. I mean, I have everything from Styrian Sauvignon Blanc to like Slovenian orange wine to
in
quantities, but
of course. I mean, that's your prerogative, and it's also good to, you know, have that for people. But that's the next question. You know, that's the list. It was designed in that period, right, and had to serve. You're there now. It ain't the 90s, right? So it's a different market. So what are the touches that you put on?
Well,
stay in the game and serve the market.
Yeah, it's a new American restaurant, right, at the end of the day. And so certainly I've thought very much about domestic wines and their place on the list. And I think that just based on what I've seen is that so we used to be on a townhouse on 61st Street. I think that probably our clientele is a little... the restaurant used to be smaller. I think it used to be much more aggressively fine dining focused than it is now, because we have a formal dining room that's white tablecloth and tasting menus and all that. And then we have like a casual sort of bar room with burgers and stuff. I think we probably moved down a little bit in terms of price point. Like, we have huge verticals of blue chip Cali, like Harlan in 9 vintages. Wow. And Bryant family and stuff like that. But frankly, I don't sell very many of them. And so I've really worked to shape the list towards getting a lot more affordable stuff on the list. Like we probably have, because we have the space for it. We have
staying in Cali, like the Harlins and Bryants are
but also
crazy, but
working into
want...
alternative varieties. So I like the wines of Matthew Rourke or Forlorn Hope and Hank up at La Clarion Farm of the Sierra Foothills. I mean, these are wines that we would sort of put in the 7% movement, the New California. You know, I don't list anything too crazy funky, but like Arnaud Roberts Trousseau, all of these sort of, a lot of the wines that like Chad Walsh would buy at Agern.
Right.
But also a big focus on mature vintages. I don't necessarily list all of them because I buy them in small quantities, but I bought a huge parcel of like 70s, 80s, and 90s Ridge that, you know, if the right person comes asking about it.
So it's, you'll buy it to have, and you know... that with certain clientele, you
right.
offer
it's
up.
To some degree, like I always try to buy something in a 5 to 6 bottle quantity, but if I can't and I only have a single bottle of it, you know, I definitely have a clientele and I'm happy to offer those wines to people who seem interested in them, you know, if that conversation goes that way. It's not like I'm trying to hoard them. Wine, I think, is for drinking.
Right.
But yeah, I just bought like... recently bought some 91 like Argyle Pinot from Cali and... bought some old Rubicon recently because I love old California. It's one of my favorite things to drink. And a lot of those wines are not, you know, crazy expensive. Sometimes, and it's crazy to look at them versus the current pricing, right? Like,
right.
I will buy a gray market, something like Diamond Creek or Spotswood for less money than the current vintage. So
really?
Yeah.
Like, so you made a move to complement the cuisine because it's American
right.
by, like
also
you said,
clientele.
Going more domestic, and the clientele wants
right.
that.
Which is, I mean, we do a lot of wine between like $80 and $140 bucks, and I wanted fun wines
that's
to sell.
That's a big sweet spot.
Yeah, I wanted to sell wines that were in there. So, you know, Forlorn Hope Barbera at $72 on the list is a great way to go, and it's farming focused, and it's very much emblematic of what's
so let's
exciting
talk about
in California
that.
To
Forlorn
be.
Forlorn Hope's a cool winery out in California. Mm-hmm. Barbera is, you know, that...
Sierra Foothills.
That
East Bay.
That Piedmont grape.
Yeah, you got it.
What gets you to that? I mean, how do you get somebody on that? It goes back to, you know, what do you drink?
Yeah.
But how does a guy wind up with that?
You know, it's mostly when they say, like, okay, I want Cali Pinot, but I want something different. Like, I mean, I certainly have a large selection of California Pinot Noir, but Barbera is very soft in terms of its
right.
tannins. Sort of middleweight,
so
juicy.
So that'll get you there.
And, you know, it's affordable, right? So I still buy a lot of classic varieties, too. It's not all weird varieties like Falanghina and Trousseau and stuff like that.
Right.
But
now, is the stuff you're talking about, the Forlorn Hope, the Arnaud Roberts, that stuff selling on
yeah.
a fairly regular
yeah,
basis?
Yeah, for sure. And there are things in my wine, they are things that my wine team likes a lot, that I like. You know, the Cabernet is going to sell itself.
Right.
Right. The Pinot Noir is going to sell itself.
Right.
I'm going to buy cool producers in each of those. Like I have Matthias and Cabernet on the list, and I have Ann Hill Farms and Drew.
All that
and
stuff's
all
reasonable,
these,
right?
You know, all those wines are, you know, under $120 on the list.
Does that translate? I guess it'd be easier in Bordeaux than Burgundy, where you could find, you know, smaller chateaus or whatever. I mean,
yeah.
You said you were bringing in
I mean,
more Bordeaux.
The great thing about Bordeaux is that it's so reliable, right? So I'll buy producers that are maybe under the radar from old. Like I have 2000 Saint-Amis on the list from a producer called Roel de Fombrage that I had never had before.
What's it called?
Roel de Fombrage.
Spell for me.
R-O-L space D-E space Fombrage, F-A-U-M-B-R-A-U-G-E.
Right.
Which I never heard of before, but it's 2000, which is anybody would put in, you know, top vintage in the last 20 years. And, you know, it's on the list for like $120, $130 bucks because I like
that's a great
Bordeaux.
Find, right?
Yeah. I have 06 enemy on the list, which is great for $80, you know. So I see the opportunity there is that you can buy relatively mature wines for not a total arm and a leg.
Right.
Which is also when Bordeaux starts to feel like Bordeaux.
Is it fair to say you've moved it more to that direction than what it was? Or it existed a little that way?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of focus by the previous beverage director around getting very big blue chip verticals on the list, which I didn't see a clientele to sell those to, and to me, the worst one.
At the Bryant Park location.
Yeah, like we got...
Because the other place was Upper East Side, moneyed neighborhood.
Exactly, and you just saw a little less of the world and a little bit more of the Upper East Side.
Right.
Good way to put it. Soldera verticals, like very, very expensive Brunello at $700 or $800 a bottle, made more sense. And
right.
So there's a lot of that stuff where I have honestly sold it at cost or close to cost, so I can get the amount of bottles down in the cellar a little bit, right. So that I can then use that to buy super fun other wine.
Right. Makes sense.
Right.
So a big thing with restaurants that I've noticed doing the show and as a consumer has been two things that jump out. One is champagne. I mean, you just see way more offerings and restaurants that go 50, 70, you know, offerings,
right.
Or, you know, 10 years ago. And natural wine, which we talked a little about
right.
Before. I want to get your take on natural wine. Is it something that's important to the Oriel list? Do you have to be careful, or you mentioned a few.
It's something that's important to me because I think we should buy wines.
So it starts
wines,
with you, which is
fair. Right. We should buy wines that were, we should reward good farmers, right? Because good farmers generally reward us with great wines, but it's both sides. If we don't support those, the people who farm that way by buying their wines.
That's Matthias.
And sell
that's
them.
Petrosky,
exactly.
Right.
But we do have a clientele who expects a certain classicism out of their wines. And I feel like at certain price points, it's much easier to get away with. Especially under $100 or so, because if, like, the great example is La Clarion Farms, right? This is Hank Beckmeyer. He makes wine up in the Sierra Foothills, all natural yeast ferments, picks all of his wines.
Just stop for a sec. Sierra Foothills, not the most famous wine growing region. Just pin it geographically for our listeners.
You're about three hours east of San Francisco, sort of up towards Tahoe.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the area.
Yeah, exactly. So he's up there, and he makes these very hands-off. His wife farms a bunch of goats, and he makes these very hands-off, which is, say, very low intervention Syrahs, you know, 12.5% alcohol, absolutely no new oak on them. He makes them in, like, resin tanks. Looks much more like winemaking in the Loire than Northern Rhone than it does here. And they're a little fuzzy, right? You know, they have a little volatile acid to them.
Right.
They're a little bready because he adds effectively almost no sulfur to them. And they're really affordable. I mean, these are domestic
but
wines.
But play well in the restaurant?
Yeah, and to me, they're the first place I take people often. And they, because they're not a total arm and a leg, there's a little bit more permission towards, well, this isn't exactly what I wanted, but it is really cool in this different way.
Right.
But then it's also about getting traditionalist producers. Like, I find so much more value in the old school guys because land prices in California have gotten so crazy. But you look at someone like Domaine Eden's Cabernet from Santa Cruz is on the list for $80. And
pretty
it blows anything I can even think about buying from Napa out of the water these days.
Really?
Almost anything.
So that's a great record.
It's getting very hard to buy Napa Cabernet for that price.
Yeah.
Because land's $300,000 an acre.
Yeah, it's crazy. Which, you know, hopefully Sonoma's starting to make a move, but that's, you know, going up in price too.
Yeah.
So you're a fan of natural wine.
For sure.
Like to expose customers to it. You curate and pick. You drink it yourself, and you're right. You want to support the farmers.
Right.
And we talked earlier about, you know, you have this fancy meal in front of you and then this manufactured wine.
Right.
You know, why not drink that? I agree with you on that. All right, I want to move on to our wine list. I want to get your take on a bunch of questions. I'm going to subject you to about 5 questions.
I'm ready.
You could buzz through them. So the first question we ask is, what are you drinking now? And that's, you know, what are you tasting? What's seasonal? What are you trying for the restaurant? What do you have a mini obsession with?
I actually a lot of Northern Rhone white right now. I mean, we're having quite a balmy spring, but certainly going into this winter season, that was a big one for me. So
what regions? Condrio or?
Yeah, well, no, more the southern, right? So Saint Perret. As well as like Crozes Hermitage Blanc, like Griots, and like I think all those wines are really underlooked. The sort of more like Grenache Blanc, you can sort of include that down into the Southern Rhone, right? And into the wines of the Roussillon,
right?
These sort of sun-loved, bitter, textural, oily sort of Southern French, which begins in the Northern Rhone but then sort of extends through there.
So Rhone whites, north and south.
Yeah.
You mentioned Griot. Give me one or two other.
Yeah, I love Herve Souhaus.
Souhaut.
Yeah, he's a Saint-Joseph producer predominantly, but he makes a a Blanc. It does. I don't think he uses an appellation for it. I don't know exactly where the vineyards are, but it's fantastic. So textural. If you got pasta and mushrooms or anything like that, it just begs for it.
Great value too, right?
Yeah. A fancy wine for tastes like very fancy white Burgundy, but.
Is it on your list?
It is, yeah.
Okay. Give me one more.
I really love the wines of Mas Julien. That's a little further to the south. They blend a little bit of Viognier in
there. Spell for me.
M-A-S space J-U-L-I-N. Yeah.
Okay.
She's an old school Rosenthal import, so you can get it up there on the Upper East Side.
Cool. Those are good ones. We'll post, all the info on our social media. All right. Give me Morgan Harris's favorite wine and food pairing. I know it's kind of a silly question, but you certainly drink enough wine, eat a lot of food. At some point, you look at the two of them together and go, this is...
Yeah. I got to say that, one of my all-time tops is...
Wait, the Grape Nation, you're not allowed to say champagne and oysters.
No. Hush. That's not going to happen.
Okay.
I think, off-dry Riesling and, pork belly, salty fatty with sweet and sour, I just think that's
great
one of the...
Great foil for that type of food.
Right, one of the... And you can include that out to sort of anything that's salty and fatty. I'm just taking pork belly because it's the most salty and the most fatty thing. But, barbecue, a lot of Chinese cooking for your takeout. Obviously, it's just, and I just like it on its own, too.
Give me a couple of recos, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. The Lauer wines, the Barrel X, that's pretty much all around town.
L-A-U-E-R?
Yeah. The Barrel X in particular is right at about $20 retail usually.
Great price point.
From Von Boden is fantastic. You've got Kohler Ruprecht that Dresner brings in. Oh my God. German spellings now. K-O-H-L-E-R space Ruprecht. R-U-R-P-R-E-C-T. C-H-T.
Listen, Ruprecht. I'm only trying to help you with your theory stuff, so don't get down on me, all right?
No.
All right, so those are good recos and really a truly good pairing that complements.
Just great food wines.
All right, I think you get out and about. Give me your favorite wine restaurant and or bar. Give me one or two picks that have the selection, the people that know what they're doing, good environment. Who's doing it right?
The wine bar scene, I think it's pretty much the reigning champion at the moment is definitely Compagnie de Vins Naturel.
Caleb.
Caleb's
a big favorite.
One of my oldest friends in the business, so I'm a little biased, but at the same
Caleb?
Time. Yeah.
But he's doing it right. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
All right, so that's a bias, but a good answer. Give me a second choice.
Yeah, so then I am so excited to check out the new Racines because I loved
Pascaline.
I loved it with Arno. But
is Arno still there? Or
No. Okay. He's
and Pascaline came in.
They've just restructured. Yeah, Pascaline, right. But they're still around. And Arno's fantastic. I just think they're sort of bringing some more heat to the bullpen, as it were.
Yep, I agree with that.
And Eric Corsi used to cook in North End and Calliope before.
Went over there.
One of my all-time favorite chefs, right? He just makes this insanely old-school, soulful French food. He's just a... I think that's going to be a big thing
going
trio.
Forward.
You just have to make it all the way downtown, too.
I know. Well, Compagnie is not,
to Chamber Street. Well, but that's even...
This
you know,
is even further.
Yeah.
It's a neighborhood away.
But if you live in Brooklyn, it's right. You're right through
across.
It, right? You know?
All right, good ones. Give me... Do you have... I never asked anybody this, but is this a silly question to ask you? Your favorite all-time wine?
Favorite? Oh, individual bottling. Okay, I'll give you a vintage. How's that?
Okay.
I think for me, and I mean this in the least snobby way possible, but the 1978s right now, if there's any old vintage you can drink from anywhere, if someone's like, you can have a random
78
bottle of wine,
anywhere? Bordeaux, yeah. California,
yeah, it's,
Italy?
They're all insane right now.
The 78.
The serious wines from that vintage.
Give me three areas. You don't have to rank
them. I have 278, Bordeaux for sure.
Bordeaux.
Cali.
Not really champagne.
Champagne's more 79. Bordeaux, Cali, and Burgundy for sure. Rhone.
So you're saying a 78 Heights Martha's Vineyard is just as good as the 74?
I don't know. I've had the 74 once.
But it's pretty good foil for it. Okay.
And then those wines are still affordable. I just bought Freemark. I have Freemark Bochet on the list right now. Freemark Abbey, the old school. They're in the Judgment of Paris. It's on the list right now. I have like a bottle of it for like $280, which again is not a cheap bottle of wine.
No, I know. But in the game, that's a fair right. price point.
So,
all right. So anything 78, good answer. First time anybody just gave a vintage. Last question, and then we're going to quickly taste a wine blind, and then we'll reveal it. You mentioned one earlier, but let's just tighten up the answer. Give me your best wine around $15-$20. I always say my kid's going to a dinner party.
Right.
Doesn't want to buy crappy wine, but he wants doesn't want to spend a ton of it. Give me a red. Give me a white. You could do region, maker.
Yeah, for sure. I just realized this the other day. I was talking to someone. The reason why French wine like is so much more affordable is because they've got all these farm subsidies. So, like, we're getting helped out here. But I think you would be very hard pressed to find a better $20 bottle of wine than Bernard Baudry's like entry level Chinon
for red,
which okay. I think is called Le Grezzo. I think is the basin one. But okay. There's a lot of his cuvées that are right around that
I'll
price,
check that
and they
out.
Just vintage in, vintage out.
Solid.
They're just incredible wines.
Give me a white.
And then in white, I drink a ton of Aligoté these days.
Aligoté,
yeah, exactly.
Which is from where?
Burgundy. It's the like one of the other grapes of Burgundy.
Right.
But it's grown all over the place. But I really like Comte Armand's.
Spell.
Comte. Comte.
Like the cheese?
Yeah, exactly. Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D. They're a good big-time Pomard producer, so you get all this like...
And your price point is where?
Yeah, that's right around 20.
Okay. And give me just a quick descriptive of what we're drinking.
So Aligoté, it's in the Chardonnay family, but it's definitely got more acid and sort of tartness to it. They're
nice.
They're never serious wines, right?
Good food wine, though.
But they're great for oysters and any sort of like fresh veggie situation and like... Tuesday nights.
Something instead of Muscadet.
Right, exactly.
Cool. All right. So, Morgan, in front of you, you have a glass of No Secret white wine. All right. Of course, I know what it is because I bought it. I just thought, because this is what you've been doing for the last 7-8 years, stick your nose in it and on a blind taste, tell me what you think we're drinking. David, you want to come in for a glass?
Yeah. It's once we're drinking, I hear. All right, we're gonna take a sip here. It's really it's savory on the balance. One of the biggest things I think about when I think about like wines in general is fundamentally fruity or fundamentally savory. It's actually, I think a lot more fat brush to small brush, right? It's not like, oh, this smells like apricots. It's like, well, this is fruity or is it savory? This is savory.
So this is savory. Okay. That helps you with a region and a grape?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Dave, you have to wait because I can't reveal the bottle yet. stay there.
It's got a little bit of fizz, which to me speaks of some, you know, particular Germanic countries, and there's a lot of nice sort of bright acid to it as well. Take another sip.
It is, I hate to use the word fizzy, which is acidity.
Yeah.
But there's a
little
prominent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Dissolved CO2.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's kind of salty, and there's this mild sort of sweet, herbaceous quality to it. Not like sweet fruity, but like basil or faux greens, right?
Not vegetal, but more savory greens.
Yeah, not as it's not Sauvignon Blanc. It doesn't have that really obnoxious asparagus.
No,
to it.
None of that.
If I had to guess, and it's not Riesling, it's not fruity enough for that. I think it's more savory.
What about, it's not fruity enough for Riesling. What about sweetness? Is that part of the fruity?
Yeah, it's for sure. I mean,
it's
sweet,
there's
no actual sweetness in it. It's really savory though. It's got that dissolved CO2 thing. That's a little bit that sweet herbaceous thing. So I don't know. It feels like it's kind of in that. And there's a lot of lees. So the sort of stale beer.
Tell people what lees are.
Yeah. So basically, they're leftovers. They're the inactive yeast cells there.
Right. They leave them.
Yeah, and they kind of smell like stale beer, like cottage cheese,
right?
Or brie rind.
All right. So stop beating around the bush. What are we drinking?
I think we're probably drinking Grüner Veltliner from Austria.
Grüner Veltliner from Austria.
From the Wachau of Federspiel quality from the,
okay,
so the 2016 vintage.
Okay, so I'm going to say you're 2 for 4.
Okay.
Here's the reveal.
Okay.
So what we're drinking is...
This is a great $20...
Yes. Well, I try to bring in wines.
Oh, fantastic.
So what we're drinking for this week's Weekly Wine Sip is a 2015. What'd you say?
16.
Okay, so you were close.
Close.
Goebelsberg, which is the producer. Schloss Kellerei, which I guess is just the designation.
That's, that's like estate, right? It's the
right.
Fortress cellar.
Gruner Veltliner from the Kamptal region. Okay, what'd you say?
I said Wachau.
Wachau.
But, you know, hop, skip, and a jump.
This wine retails for, Dave, you can come in now. This wine retails for about $16. It's a Terry Thies selection.
Yeah, fabulous.
Who, you know, he's not putting out bad wines.
For sure.
And it's available at better wine stores. I know what the alcohol is. What are you guessing it is?
I would guess somewhere between 12.5 and 13.
It's 12.5, exactly. So that makes it very drinkable.
Fabulous with food.
So what else can you tell me? Good producer, Goebelsberg?
Yeah, Goebelsberg is one of the great producers in the Kamptal. The Wachau is like the real heavy hitter region, but if you're going to drink somebody in the Kamptal, which is, it's not lesser, it's just a little bit more obscure.
Right.
Goebelsberg is the top producer.
I had Jay McInerney in here, and I think they make a wine called Tradition.
Uh-huh.
And it tasted like a Burgundy, and I know he was like a big Burgundy guy, and he couldn't figure it out, and that was the whole point, you know, to put him on
Jay's,
the line.
Jay's great. Just Jay drinks a lot of fancy wine.
Yeah.
And for better or worse.
But I knew it was a Burgundian, Austrian wine.
Well, the greatest thing about these wines is how, like, you can drink the very, very greatest producers for not a total arm and a leg.
Right. Which is
great. You can come drink, literally the best producers, best vineyards for like $120 or $130 on my list. And the regular, everyday affordable stuff is also fantastic as well.
The category is, great.
The price ceiling, quality floor is very high.
Right. All right, before we wrap up, let's do a quick analysis. So it's that classic sort of pale yellow, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Give me your nose descriptors on this.
So to me, like the fruit character does have is very much in that sort of pomaceous, so green apple, golden apple, just pristinely ripe with this sort of backbone of lemony yellow acidity and liminess.
Definitely citrus there.
I always get a little bit of like underripe green pineapple on Gruner in particular. I'm not one much for like wild hair notes, but
all right, that's a good one.
I think that's legit. Sort of umeboshi, like a sour plum sort of thing to it.
All right, what about mouthfeel? It's
pretty 2%-y.
What does that mean?
Like 2% milk.
Oh.
You know, I just think
I thought like 2-T-O-O presenty, PR, presenting itself
like,
too much.
I think the easiest way to understand body in wine is skim 2% whole milk.
Got you.
Right?
So it's sort of a medium.
Yeah, exactly.
Minus.
It is what everybody who drinks Pinot Grigio should be drinking instead.
Right. So right there, here's a guy who's devoted, the last 8-10 years of his life to wine. He's telling you to drop Pinot Grigio, and here's an alternative in the price, in the quality, that's different.
Made by human beings.
All right, so let's go palate.
Okay.
What do we, a lot of the stuff I think we described.
I think you do get, it sort of exacerbates that, Gruner is always centers for me around the spicy root vegetables, arugula, watercress, turnip, parsnip, whatever you want to call it, but I think I get a deeper sense of that on the palate. You get this sort of bitter radish.
I get that. This particular wine, right, too. I get the salt you mentioned earlier, right, which leads me to a little iodine.
I think that's part of what makes it food friendly. But
that was my next question. The acidity is good on this wine, right?
But also the bitterness. So it works great with like artichoke.
So give me your pairing.
Asparagus. It is
hard every, green vegetables.
It is every sommelier's like answer to like a nightmare.
It's
vegetable
the nightmare
situation.
Vegetable,
like Slayer.
There you go.
Arugula, watercress, turnip, parsnip.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Put me in prison if I have to eat those vegetables the rest of my life.
That's the one of the traditional pairings is white asparagus because they're wild about that in Austria.
Right.
The Spargel is what they call it.
So do we like this wine?
I like it very much.
Good wine for the money.
Absolutely.
Good wine to bring to a dinner party
if you
knew what they're cooking. Okay, good.
I think this is totally the sort of thing that I would pick up a case of at the beginning of the summer, and if we make it through it by the end of the summer, then great. But if not, we can drink it in the fall.
For sure. All right, Morgan, we're going to wrap up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's Sam at thegrapenation.com. You can follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. That's where I'll post Morgan's wine list answers. I'll list the wine we're drinking, and we'll also put down a bunch of other recos he made during the show. And like I said, I'll put down our weekly wine sip info. You could follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, and now you can follow hashtags. So follow the hashtag TheGrapeNation, and we're at Twitter at BenRuby. Morgan, if we want to follow you, follow Oriol, where should we go?
Oriol, I think, is on all its social media under Oriol NY.
Right.
And I'm just under Morgan W. Harris, okay. My initial. Right. It's all together. That's Instagram and Twitter.
I mean, you're astute at social media, but you're not a heavy user, I would say.
Yeah, right? I mean, I don't do Facebook just because it interacts with a bad corner of my brain.
I don't either, except for the show. You know, the show's different.
Yeah, I haven't had one
me.
Since 2010, but I was an early adopter because I was in Boston in 2004. Remember when Facebook was just colleges?
That's right. That's right.
But yeah, I do a lot of Instagram and a lot of Twitter. Cool. So, and I'm always happy to get back to people. If people have questions, just DM me, and I'm
so that's
I'm
Morgan G-A-N W Harris H-A-R-I-S
Morgan like Morgan Freeman,
right?
W like the letter W, and then Harris like as an Ed.
That's where you can find Morgan. And if you're in Oriel in New York City, look for Morgan. He'll certainly steer you in the right direction. All right, I want to thank our guest Morgan Harris. Morgan Harris is the head somm at Oriel in New York City. I want to thank our engineer David tonight, who's sitting in for Vitor. David
happy birthday,
and I, David, right? Happy birthday to Vitor. David and I are heading to Charleston tomorrow. We're going to be broadcasting live from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival, which will be on the on-tour and live section. And thank you to everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.